Welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel of the New Books Network, where we talk with philosophers about their new book. I'm Carrie Figdor, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese. Today's interview is with Eric Marcus, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Auburn University. His book, Rational Causation, is just out from Harvard University Press. We often explain actions and beliefs by citing the reasons for which they are done or believed. The reason I took off my hat at the funeral was because I was paying respects to the deceased. And the reason I believed that taking off my hat was appropriate was because I believed that the deceased deserved respect. So much is part of what is sometimes called the space of reasons and reason giving, a space that people occupy, but objects like apples don't. We can explain an apple's falling because the wind blew strongly, but the explanation doesn't require us to ascribe any reasons to the apple. Acting for reasons is reserved for creatures with minds. But what is the difference in the because when we say that I took off my hat because I was paying my respects, and that the apple fell because the wind blew? How is this difference to be explained? Marcus takes on this complex question in an intriguingly unorthodox fashion. The orthodox view tries to assimilate rational causation to the same causal picture we use for apples. Marcus challenges the physicalistic framework in which this answer is embedded and argues for a position that is neither reductive nor dualistic. On his view, rational causation is a kind of difference-making that involves the exercise of special rational abilities. And as a result of these abilities, minds make a robust causal difference to what we do and what we believe that is independent of the way in which minds depend on brain. Let's turn to the interview. Hi, I'm with Eric Marcus. Are you there?
Hi.
Hi, Eric. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
I'm glad to be here.
So your new book, Rational Causation from Harvard University Press, is a highly unorthodox approach to a problem within the general context of the problem of mental causation. And that is, you know, how we are supposed to explain the sorts of reasons giving explanations that we give when we talk about why we might believe something or why we act when we have reasons for these things. And the topic itself is fairly complicated. So before we get into the actual details of the book, it might be good to just start with a little bit of background about yourself, how you got into philosophy, and then how you got to this particular topic of rational causation.
Sure. I had an interest in philosophy pretty early. When I was a child, I remember being genuinely worried about whether the world really existed or not, and whether it was just a trick that was being played on me. I remember walking down the street once and actually, whirling around to try and catch the world not existing behind me. So when I read Descartes, I think I read Descartes as a teenager. It was a kind of thinking that appealed to me, that I somehow felt very at home thinking that way. And so I ended up pursuing a PhD in philosophy. And one of the things I was worried about, one of the philosophical problems that really troubled me was whether we could really make sense of the idea that there were people in a physical world. I was worried about whether we were nothing but atoms in the void. And the problem of mental causation in particular struck me as really troublesome. And that was what I ended up writing my dissertation on. And this book project, in a way, comes out of that. So in my dissertation, I was worried about the problem of exclusion. If physical events have complete physical causal histories, could physical events really have any other kind of causes? And if physical events can't have any other kinds of causes, how does the mind really get in on any of the world's causal actions, so to speak? And the strategy that I pursued in my dissertation was kind of, I guess you could say, a quietist strategy. I argued that a physical event could have a complete physical causal history and also have other kinds of causes as well. And the idea was to preempt the problem of mental causation by allowing for overdetermination. And one, I'd say the most frequent grounds for resistance to the strategy that I encountered was that people complained that I lacked a positive view. I wasn't saying how it was that the mind made a difference. I was just telling people not to worry about it, since nothing ruled out that the mind could make a difference. You know, the problem of exclusion didn't successfully rule that out. And I'm not sure that I agree with that criticism, but I also I started to have views about how the mind mattered, and views that were inspired by a lot of work, I guess you could say, in the Anscombe tradition of recent analytic philosophy. And that's basically how I ended up writing this book.
Good. So maybe it might be helpful before we sort of get into the nitty gritty to kind of lay out the problem of rational causation, maybe with an example or two, and then the orthodox view that you are arguing against.
Okay. Well, I guess we could, you know, start out just by saying a little bit about the very idea of rational explanation. So I guess what's common ground among different kinds of theorists is that there is a certain class of explanations that are distinctive in certain ways, explanations of action and belief, among other things, that give the actor or believers reason for acting or believing. And a couple of ways that these explanations are distinctive is, first, that reasons tell you what the agent thought there was to be said for performing the action or for adopting the belief. So, you know, if you ask me why I'm going to the store and I say I'm getting potatoes or something, getting potatoes is something that I thought, you know, spoke in favor of the action, spoke in favor of going to the store, justified it in a certain thin sense, or, you know, to take an example of belief, if you ask me why I think that the butler did it, I might say, well, everyone else has an alibi. Again, this is a reason for, part of what makes this a reason for belief is that it supports the conclusion that, you know, the butler did it. So there is this connection between reasons and justification. Also, whereas in an ordinary causal explanation, the thing that explains doesn't have to be known by anybody. So if I say that, you know, someone got into a fight because he had very low blood sugar, it's not any kind of objection to that explanation to say, you know, but he didn't know his blood sugar was very low. So ordinary causal explanations, there is no kind of requirement of awareness. But if you say that I'm going to the store to get some potatoes, that's my reason for going to the store, you can't follow that up and say, although he doesn't know it. Or if someone says, but he doesn't think he's going to get potatoes, the whole explanation becomes kind of obscure. So there seems to be this connection between reasons and awareness. And also, in the case of action explanations, reasons have this forward-looking character. So people act with certain ends in mind, you know, at the end of getting potatoes. Anyway, so this is just the, to introduce the kind of the idea of rational explanations. But so the orthodox view, I guess, what I call psychologism in the book, analyzes rational explanation in terms of causation by belief and desire in the case of action, or in terms of just belief in in the case of why we believe. Mm-hmm. So according to the Orthodox view, it's just a species of causal explanation, and it has to be just a species of causal explanation, or else how else could it be an explanation at all? So the idea is, if I'm going to the store to get some potatoes, I believe that by going to the store I can get some potatoes, and I want some potatoes, and that belief and that desire get together somehow, and they prompt the bodily movement that constitutes the action. Mm-hmm. Or if I believe that everyone else has an alibi, that prompts the belief that the butler did it. And so, according to the Orthodox view, sense beliefs and desires are causes of bodily movements. They have to be physical or physically realized. And I think this speaks to how philosophers think about causation, especially when they're doing philosophy of mind and philosophy of action. So it's assumed, I guess it's sort of taken for granted mostly, that wherever you have causation, you have something like implementing mechanisms, and that mental states prompt actions via mechanisms. So this is just efficient causation. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that in theories of causation, when philosophers are just thinking about what causation is, even apart from thinking about the philosophy of mind or action, this idea, this commitment to efficient causation shows up when causation is explained in terms of laws, so as it often is. And so if you think there is this connection between causation and laws, then you think that the most revealing description of how a cause and effect are connected is going to invoke how the laws play out in this particular case. And the way my view is different is that I argue that rational causation consists in something else. It's not the manifestation of natural laws. It's the manifestation of certain rational abilities that I spend the first couple of chapters of the book talking about.
So let me just step in for a moment. So the view that you call psychologism is sort of general. It's part of a general view, sometimes called naturalism or physicalism, in which you have mental states, beliefs, intentions, desires, and so forth. These are connected intimately in some way or other to, in our case, neural states. And it's in virtue of the fact that you have a connection between, say, a neural state and some other, bodily state, or between two neural states, that you get the causal relationship between the first belief and the second belief, or the intention and the action, or the movement, I should say. And that relationship between the mental states, or the mental state and the movement, is explained in terms of a causal relationship between the neural states and the bodily movement, or between the two neural states.
Right.
Okay. So that's the traditional, or sort of the more or less orthodox view. As you indicated when you talked about your dissertation on mental causation, I did mine on mental causation as well, but a different problem. That will lead to the problem of causal exclusion, as you put it, that, if you've got these neural causes, right, the neural one state connected to another neural state, what is left for the beliefs to do? And I take it that problem is what prompts you to reject the orthodox view and go for something, completely different. So let's get into exactly how different it is. So you explain it in terms not of a neural state connected to another neural state, right, which underlie the, you know, the beliefs or the beliefs in the movement, but in terms of a rational ability to, as you put it, represent one thing as being believed on the basis of something of another belief, or being done on the basis of something else's being done. So could you maybe explain the nature of this?
Sure.
Representation.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of the core of
right.
In chapters 1 and 2, you use the same framework for both believing and acting.
Right. Well, let's start with the theoretical case. I think that the best way to introduce the idea is in terms of a variant of Moore's paradox. So the traditional version of Moore's paradox is, you know, it's raining, but I don't believe that it's raining. My variant goes like this. Everyone else has an alibi, so the butler did it. But I don't believe the butler did it because everyone else has an alibi. Both of these statements are puzzling, I think, in the same way. In both cases, something is put forward and then taken back. In the one case, it's a belief, and in the other case, it's something else. And I think what it is believing one thing on the basis of another. So part of almost any explanation of the absurdity of more paradoxical statements is that the first conjunct expresses a mental state, and then you have this, this statements like S believe that P that are typically used to ascribe that very state. And I think that, you know, S believes that P because S believes that Q is typically used to ascribe a mental state that one can express by saying something like Q, so P. So I think that there is a single mental state that I describe this way. The subject views the to be believedness of P as following from the to be believedness of Q.
So to clarify, this state that we ascribe, P is to be believed because Q is to be believed, is itself a complex mental state that is distinct from simply P is to be believed or something like that. Is that correct?
Right. It's an attitude that, you know, it's an attitude that presupposes or that involves both believing that P or thinking of P as to be believed and thinking of Q as to be believed. But it's distinctive. It's seeing the to be believedness of P as a consequence of the to be believedness of Q.
Okay. Go on.
So instead of having, you know, instead of a mental, you know, so one way, I guess the traditional way of thinking about believing for a reason, you know, believing for a reason on the orthodox view would be that you have these two mental states and then something like a non-mental relation between them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the relation of causation is not itself a mental relation. Rather, it's, you know, this general relation of causation, and it connects these two beliefs. But on the kind of view that, on the view that I'm arguing for, the causation itself is a function of, is part of the attitude that the subject is taking towards the relation between the propositions. So in some sense, the causation is internal to the attitude. So when you say, you know, he thinks that the butler did it because he thinks that everyone else has an alibi,
mm-hmm.
what you're doing is you are saying, you know, he has a mental state that he could express this way, Q, so P. And it's the so that we understand kind of from the first person perspective that you know, your explanation latches onto.
So is this so? I mean, this one of the things that I got from the book was this sort of pluralism about the causal relationship. So when you say Q, so P, I mean, that's a single complex mental state, which sort of incorporates within it the rational causal relationship. And so my question was, is the nature of the relationship that's represented in that complex, is that a different sort of causal relationship from the one that the orthodox view posits between, you know, Q causing P?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there are various kind of symptoms of it being different. I mean, one symptom of it being different is that, you know, in the theoretical case, rational cause and effect are necessarily simultaneous. So believing for a reason isn't, you know, believing, you know, that it's not when my believing that everyone else has an alibi leads to my believing that the butler did it.
Right. That's the orthodox view.
Yeah. Rather, it's my believing at a single time that you know, both beliefs have to be, as it were, indexed to the same time. It's my believing at once, you know.
Q so P.
Yeah. And so rational causation in the theoretical case is necessarily simultaneous.
So let me press this sort of, you know, obvious kind of response, which is just, well, gosh, you know, I mean, causes precede their effects. You know, it's one thing followed by another thing. What is it that makes this relationship, if it is simultaneous, right? What is it that makes it causal?
That's a fair question. We go back to, you know, the problem of mental causation. We say, well, you know, why are we interested in the problem of mental causation? We're interested in the problem of mental causation because it's important that the mind make a difference to what happens. You know, we wonder, you know, does what I believe really affect things? Does it really matter? You know, do my ends really affect things? Do they matter? You know, we care about this question in part because of the plausibility of Alexander's dictum, according to which to be real is to cause. But the issue, you know, that dictum is plausible and powerful, not if it's interpreted as saying something like, you know, to be real is to, you know, is to cause in some specific way, you know, through forces or waves or whatever. So the issue, the very general issue, is not whether things matter in this way or that, but whether they matter, period. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to explain what sort of difference rational explanations portray the mental as making. So the difference that my belief that everyone else has an alibi makes, the difference that rational explanations portray it as making, has this feature, say this feature of simultaneity. This is a real difference that belief makes. And that it makes a difference in this way is enough, you know, so to speak, to clear the bar for realness that's set up by Alexander's dictum. So yes, the kind of causal explanations that I'm describing, you know, that kind of causation that I'm describing in this book is radically unlike ordinary causation in a number of ways. The simultaneity is one thing, is one aspect. In the practical case, I think that rational effects are parts of the actions that they're caused by, and that's also very odd. But these are also not constitutive explanations. They're explanations that appeal to factors that make a difference in a distinctive way. And so once one allows, as I argue we should, that the very things we cite in rationally explaining belief and action are difference makers, and that the understanding conveyed by giving someone's reason for belief or action constitutes a grasp of the way these difference makers make a difference, then I think, in a sense, whether we label it causation or not becomes less interesting. I do think that causation, especially in philosophy, sometimes does have this sense of being a difference maker at a very high level of generality. And I think when it has that sense, you know, if we give it that sense that, you know, what I'm calling rational causes, they really deserve that label, even though they're so unlike ordinary kinds of causes.
So you see causation in a much, it sounds like you generalize it to something like difference making.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not trying to give a reductive analysis of causation. Obviously, there are kinds of difference making which I think we would clearly want to separate from causal explanations, and, you know, certainly constitutive explanations might be among them. But I don't think rational causal explanations fit comfortably into that category either. But I don't know. I don't mean to anticipate your question.
No, that's okay. I just I guess this was one of the features of the book that I found, you know, very intriguing. And so I just wanted to explore it a little bit.
Sure.
A little bit more. So maybe we can talk about action and continue the exploration.
Sure.
Yeah, give a case of, you know, doing something as opposed to believing something.
Sure. Well, let me say, you know, I guess what the parallel, I mean, you mentioned earlier that I kind of try to give accounts that have the same structure for both belief and action. So on the view that I argue for, just as when I say that you believe P because you believe Q, I'm attributing to you a thought of the form Q is to be believed, so P is to be believed. When I say that you are Xing because you're Ying, I'm attributing to you a thought of the form Ying is to be done, so Xing is to be done. So we could start with, I think, you know, and that's, so we could start, I think, with this idea, which I think is pretty uncontroversial, that there's some connection between doing something and thinking of it as the thing to do, or as I put it, representing it as to be done. So, I've decided that I should bring potato salad to the party. And once I've decided that that is the thing to do, then certain other things will also look like they are to be done as well. So, for example, buying potatoes. And in this way, I can extend a normative status from end to means, from bringing potato salad to the party to buying potato salad. Now, the unusual claim, or the claim that I know that people find odd, is that acting is nothing more than according a normative status. Acting is nothing more, you know, than representing something as to be done. So what I'm saying is what it is to be bringing potato salad to the party is to be representing bringing potato salad to the party as to be done. And what it is to be bring potatoes, you know, going to the store to get potatoes, et cetera, is extended from the bringing to the store going.
So let me and this was another thing that that I found very intriguing. It sounded like, and you really should correct me. It sounded like action was a kind of representing rather than a kind of doing, and I wasn't quite sure I got what you meant by that.
Right. I guess it can sound like what I'm doing is kind of pushing actions back into the head or something like that.
Right.
But actually what I'm doing is pushing thoughts out into the world, or that's the idea. So the idea is that some of our movements are themselves direct manifestations of our practical rationality. So my going to the store is my answer to the question of what to do. It is the conclusion of my deliberation. And because it is, my actions have this feature, which is otherwise very mysterious, that I can explain. You know, if you ask me what I'm doing, I can say I'm going to the store, or I'm buying potatoes, say, without having to observe myself or to look at evidence, without having to take the sort of view of myself that you would have to take to figure out what I'm doing. So we speak with a certain kind of authority about our actions, and this is not mysterious if our actions are themselves judgments of a certain kind, whereas if actions are mechanical events, it is extremely mysterious. We also, I think, treat actions as embodying judgments of what to do. And because we think of them this way, we think that actions are themselves fit subject for questions of justification. So if I see you doing something, I say, you know, why are you doing that? I mean, it's the action itself is, as it were, a statement that you view something as to be done. And I say, well, why are you doing that? It's like the action itself is something that justification is suitable for.
So is this again? Are you? Would it be correct to say that you're sort of extending or generalizing the notion of a judgment?
Yes. I mean, I don't know about generalizing, but yes, I'm. I guess what I'm saying is that extending or generalizing the notion of judgment. I'm saying that in some sense, judgments can be, as it were, embodied in actions. When I say acting is representing as something as to be done, I'm not talking about sentences in the language of thought floating in the head or images in phenomenal consciousness. Rather, I'm saying that there are certain kind of movements of certain special animals, right, us, that themselves have certain features of judgments, I guess you could say. Okay. And I think I worry that we haven't kind of I haven't gotten to the causation part, but so I think when there's this other feature of actions which is also puzzling when you do something for a reason. If I see you going to the store, and I say, why are you going to the store? And you say, I'm making potato salad. This explanation connects certain things you're doing now to a complex action. And there's, if we just look at kind of the mechanical facts about what's going on with you now, there isn't, there's nothing there that it seems like connects it to this larger action. Mm-hmm. And so the view that I'm arguing for is that what it is for you to be buying potatoes because you're bringing potato salad to the party is just for you to have inferred, as it were, that buying potatoes is the thing to do because bringing potato salad to the party is the thing to do.
So inference itself becomes embodied.
Just as in the theoretical case, the causation itself is a matter of the agents. It's a matter of the agents drawing a practical, in this case, conclusion from a practical premise. But yes, that practical inferential judgment that constitutes the causation is itself embodied in a movement.
Now, one of the in after you introduce the view in the first couple of chapters, you also address the problem of other animals, right? Because you make sort of the self-conscious expressibility of the reason as a necessary condition, I believe. And animals, of course, can't, typically do not express their reasons for things. And yet we will often want to say that, you know, the dog is sitting at the door because sitting at the door is an indicator, indicates wanting to go out in some way. And the reason that they're sitting in front of the door is because they want to go out. And so animals do things for reasons, but they don't seem to satisfy your requirement for being able to express those reasons.
Right.
So maybe you could tell us how you deal with that problem of animals, you know, doing things for reasons, but not having the full sort of cognitive capacities that we do.
Right. So I do treat believing and acting for a reason as essentially self-conscious. And I mean, I actually think this is a datum that theories have to explain. And it follows from this that animals are excluded. And I mean, I guess I could start by saying, you know, certainly in the case of people, there is this connection that when you say that someone is doing something for a reason or they believe for a reason, you know, to the extent that we view this reason as unavailable for the person to give, we become more doubtful that this really is their reason. But I know that this is a feature of the view that's going to put people off. And so I have a chapter where I try and, you know, make it go down a little more smoothly. And what I argue is that my view is consistent with animals having a lot, by way of kind of cognitive capacity. I think animals are knowers, that animals know on the basis of perception, and that they are responsive to what they know. But I argue they don't believe, because belief, at least as traditionally understood, is a matter of viewing a proposition as true, and animals don't understand propositions. So in the case of people, you know, I don't count someone as believing something if they don't possess the conceptual wherewithal to understand the relevant proposition. And animals, this is a requirement that as far as I know, although nothing really hangs on this empirical statement being true, but as far as I know, animals don't grasp propositions, you know, and if some do, that's fine too. Let them be rational animals also. But so I argue that whereas belief relates a believer to a proposition, knowledge relates a knower to a fact. And so we can say, you know, so it's consistent with the view that I argue for, that animals do know things, that animals, you know, react on the basis of what they know, but they aren't rational animals in the sense that we are. And that's because there is this tie between self-consciousness, rationality, and understanding. And animals lack all of those things.
Well, then how... this was another intriguing part, was this relationship then between belief and knowledge. The standard, of course, JTB, justified
right.
true belief analysis of knowledge. You can't, that presumably you think that that is incorrect, right? And not because of Gettier type problems, but because the relationship between knowing and believing, it just isn't one of hold apart.
I think that it may, that knowledge, that in the case of humans, knowledge that P entails belief that P.
Uh-huh.
So I think knowledge takes, argue that knowledge takes a different form in humans and animals. The basis for this argument, or the way this argument gets off the ground, is through an argument of Zeno Wendler's. So Wendler kind of observes that that P can refer either to a proposition or to a fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether you want me to it's at least, we have to at least allow for the possibility that when you say S believes that P might refer to one thing. When you say S knows that P might refer to something else. And then there are, I think, pretty convincing arguments that in the context of belief, that P refers to a proposition, whereas in the context of, knowledge, that P refers to a fact. So a lot of what we say about animals, I think, can be true without it being true that they grasp propositions. I don't know whether you want me to rehearse those arguments here
Well, the idea was just to understand how you handled the problem of expressibility, that condition for our rational, for our acting or believing for reasons, and animals not being able to do that. And I take it that your response is, well, they can act for reasons because they are aware of facts.
Yeah, I think that we have these explanations that I think are left entirely intact by what I have to say, which is, we can say, I can say that Opie is pawing open the pantry door because he wants some treats, or because treats are inside. And there's nothing that I say that somehow deprives us of taking those explanations at face value. It's just that the kind of capacity that we invoke of the cat is an epistemic capacity and not a doxastic capacity. So when I say, if I say that, I say that Sam is opening the pantry door because there are cookies inside, it's part of the truth conditions of that claim, or this claim cannot be true in any case if Sam doesn't have the concept of a cookie, or Sam is incapable of grasping the proposition that, that cookies are in the pantry. And so when we deploy this kind of explanation, these explanations in some way, they're very similar. I think we can often use the same words, but the requirements when we give this kind of explanation in the case of a person are very different than they are when we give this kind of explanation of the behavior of an animal. And I think that the differences, there's a bunch of, I guess, interrelated differences. Like, and again, it's, I think this, what's required in the case of a person is both self-consciousness and understanding. The ability to say what you're doing, the ability to say why you're doing it, if there is a reason for doing it. And these two things are connected. And in the case of animals, our explanations like this don't require anything like that of them. And so that's why I think there's a fundamental difference between the explanations in the two kinds of cases. And so I think we ought to be giving different kinds of theories of the human responsiveness to reason and whatever the animal analog of that is. So I guess I kind of think it's a virtue of the account, but I know that it won't play that way for everyone.
How do you see the relationship between explanation and causation on this view? So you respond to the sort of, I don't know if it's orthodox, but the Davidsonian view or received view, in which you have causal relations between particular events as they are subsumed under laws. And then explanations can advert to or designate these causal relationships, but they don't have to in order to be explanatory. What for you is the relationship between explanation and causation?
I'll say something specific about rational causation, rational explanation.
Yeah.
I think that it's an upshot of my view that the very things that we cite in rationally explaining belief in action are rational causes, and also that the understanding that is conveyed by giving someone's reason for belief or action constitutes a grasp of the nature of a causation that links the reason and its effect. And so, you know, it's not just that, you know, somehow when we give people's reasons, we're lashing on to, you know, bits of the physical world, which through principles that have nothing to do with what we learn from the explanations, produce the effects. Rather, the principles that tie cause to effect are the same as the principles that illuminate what happens for us.
So you just don't have that gap.
So there's no gap. And, of course, I think this is also a virtue of the account. I think it's, you know, it's always, I found, a disappointing feature of, a lot of the traditional views of rational explanation, that there is this divorce between the conceptual structure of our understanding of rationality and the metaphysical character of what underlies the relation between cause and effect.
So that's good. So to move towards the end of the book, you kind of widen your scope to some general metaphysical theses about events and states, and in particular to physicalism. So I wanted to make sure that we get to, in particular, to your view on physicalism. So let me start with that and maybe go back to events and states. maybe your answers will require you to do that anyway. But you, about physicalism, you first of all, you characterize your view as sort of between, you know, sort of naturalism and non-naturalism. And you say that you agree with a sort of a global supervenience thesis, but nothing stronger than that. So if you might explain your view in relation to the sort of standard physicalist or naturalist view in terms of the relation between reasons, explanation, or rational causation and physical causation, or mental states and physical states.
Okay, well, that there are a lot of questions in there. So let me, I mean, there's something pretty simple I can say, which is that every physicalist that I've ever talked to thinks that it's central that physics and chemistry and, you know, in any case, the physical sciences carve nature at the joints, and that in some sense they have a monopoly on causation, that all causation must be, if not physical, then mechanistic, where mechanistic means, you know, ultimately physical.
Mm-hmm.
And I reject that. So I feel like it's this very there's this very straightforward way in which I reject physicalism. And I'm not a dualist in the sense that I'm not arguing for immaterial substances. I'm trying to understand what it might mean to say that we are rational animals. You know, I think we are animals. We have certain capacities that distinguish us from other animals, and those are the topics, you know, of the first few chapters of the book.
Mm-hmm.
As far as states and events go, yeah, I mean, I have a chapter where I argue for a view of states and events, and that view informs the particular form that, you know, my anti-physicalist arguments take. Putting a lot of the detail aside, I think most metaphysicians think state identity is a function of causal powers. So, you know, state A is identical to state B if they have the same causal powers. State realization is also a matter of, you know, state A realizes state B if state B has, you know, contributes a subset of the causal powers to the objects that have it, as the realizing state does. If mental states have causal powers, if they contribute causal powers, to use this vernacular, this language, if mental states contribute causal powers to the objects that are in mental states that aren't contributed by physical states, then mental states are not physical states and are also not realized by physical states.
So let me just for clarification. What would you say is the relationship then between, say, minds and brains?
I don't produce any formula that, you know, that's particularly new about this. I mean, I guess what I'm saying, I'm open to finding out what the relation is between minds and brains. Obviously there are all kinds of specific dependencies between, you know, this cognitive ability, particular cognitive abilities on specific parts of the brain and parts of the brain doing very specific things. And I find all that stuff very interesting, and none of it is, you know, inconsistent with what I'm arguing about. So obviously there are these relations of dependency that can be more or less specific. And a lot of that's just, you know, empirical these are empirical questions that I don't think it's my place to speak about.
But it seems like the strongest connection that you want to have is a global supervenience thesis, right? Which notoriously is quite weak.
Well, right? I'm going to reject identity. Uh-huh. And I'm going to reject realization, because mostly these depend on the physical state or event or whatever,
uh-huh,
kind of having all of the causal power that the mental state does or the mental event does.
Uh-huh.
And so all that kind of identity or realization, all of those kinds of theses, I'm going to reject. Uh-huh. I think all that's wrong. There's something more illuminating to say about the relation between the mind, the mental and the physical, than that, in an identical physical universe, everything would be the same mentally. Obviously there's something more illuminating to say about that. But I don't think that whatever more illuminating there is to say about that, that it supports the reductive aspirations of naturalism. And I also don't think that, given that I'm arguing that, given that I'm arguing that mental states have, distinctive causal powers that can't be reduced to the physical, like whatever that turns out to be is not going to be something that would satisfy the physicalist. The mere dependencies is never going to be something that satisfies the physicalist, because the physicalist is going to reject, these kinds of unreduced causal powers.
Yes. That's quite true. So you are sort of consciously swimming against a very strong tide here. The whole, not necessarily reductionistic, but certainly the idea that even if you have these complex mental attitudes, Q, so P, the physicalist would still respond something like, so we have a rational ability to have these complex states, and they are, having those particular complex states can be mechanistically explained. Maybe that's a type of constitutive explanation, not conceptual, but in terms of what it's made of. And that doesn't have to be reductive, either. Would that sort of a view, are you open to that?
I'm not sure. Actually, I'm not sure I understand the view that you just described. Run it by me one more time.
Okay. The idea is that you get the rational abilities, that you posit to have attitudes of these complex, Q, so P, right? Or some sort of to be done, X is to be done because Y is to be done. And these, so to take the initial case, the Q, so P, so far that's your view. And then the question is, well, what sort of relationship is there going to be between an attitude of Q, so P, and what's going on in the brain? I was just asking if you think it's perfectly consistent with what you've said, that the complex mental state of Q, so P might have some sort of mechanistic explanation in terms of lower neural goings on, but is not reducible to them, and certainly is not identical to them. Would that would that sort of a picture be too...
It just depends on the nature and the ambition of the explanation.
Okay.
You know, so I think we just have to be, you know, I just have to hear in more detail what exactly the explanation was trying to accomplish. I mean, if it's just, you know, illuminating, you know, what has to be going on, you know, in the brain, in order for these kinds of abilities to exist or to be exercised on, you know, on particular occasions or something like that, then that's fine.
Uh-huh.
But if it's, you know, I don't see how it could be. I don't think it makes sense. I don't think it could make sense to say that somehow the causation itself, that, you know, the kind of causal connection that exists between believing that P and believing that Q, in the case of rational causation, could consist in, you know, an efficient causal mm-hmm. connection. So yeah, so if the, you know, but again, I think I would just have to, I think we just have to look at a very detailed explanation. I mean, in the book, I try and examine, you know, the specific arguments that various physicalists have made and show how the arguments or how the positions kind of run afoul of the distinctiveness of rational causation.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. I was trying to sort of forge a somewhat of a connection, I suppose, between the naturalistic perspective that would still preserve your explanation of rational causation.
The thing you're describing, I think it could be perfectly innocuous by my lights or not, depending on how the details go.
Right.
Well,
I think actually we are out of time. So this has been a very illuminating conversation for me.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Maybe you can give us a preview of what your next big project is.
Right now I have a paper about the connection between believing and knowing that you believe, and also a paper about agent causation.
Uh-huh.
And both of these are related to the project in the book. So I argue in a paper about belief that to believe is to know you believe, and in the paper about agent causation, I argue that various theories of agent causation have misunderstood the nature of the kind of efficacy that agents have. So that's what I'm working on now.
Very good. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Eric Marcus, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Auburn University, about his new book, Rational Causation, just out from Harvard University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.